WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latte from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. And first this morning, President Bush announced a historically unique plan to inject hundreds of billions of dollars of capital into banks by purchasing equity shares.
Second, and effective immediately, the FDIC will temporarily guarantee most new debt issued by insured banks. This will address one of the central problems plaguing our financial system. Banks have been unable to borrow money, and that has restricted their ability to lend to consumers and businesses. When money flows more freely between banks, it will make it easier for Americans to borrow for cars and homes and for small businesses to expand.
The president also announced that the FDIC will immediately and temporarily expand government insurance to cover all non-interest-bearing transaction accounts. These are primarily used by small businesses. And fourth, he announced that the Federal Reserve will soon finalize work on a new program to serve as a buyer of last resort for commercial paper. That's commercial or corporate debt. We'll talk about all those things. We'll play more clips from the president's announcement and keep talking about the credit and financial emergencies with a few guests to start off with us first with reaction to these new developments, but also some bigger thoughts about how we got here and where we're going. Economist John K. Galbraith, author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too. He's a University of Texas professor, and he's one contributor to a new Harper's Magazine forum called How to Save Capitalism in their November edition. Dr. Galbraith, welcome back to WNYC. Good morning.
Thanks. Nice to be with you. I should say it's James Galbraith.
Did I say John James, of course.
John is my father, who, if he were still with us, would be 100 years old tomorrow.
That's right. I know that you're his son and carrying on in the family business. First on the latest developments, did you see the president's four-point plan, and what do you think of it?
Well, I have seen it, and in fact, I think it is extraordinarily close to the program I outlined in the Washington Post on September 25th. So it's very interesting that they've come around to a set of steps which are I think, really dictated by the reality of the situation.
What do you like about it? Everybody's taking credit now for fighting the credit crunch. You wrote these...
I did. On the 25th of September, I said that what the FDIC needs to do is to basically insure all bank deposits, that you need to put about $200 billion or more into preferred equity into the banking system, and that you need to deal with the commercial paper issue with stabilizing the money market funds. So this is now happening. This should be, I think, pretty close. It's hard to say that anything is going to be decisive, but this should remove the element of fear, which had been destabilizing both the banking system and threatening to destabilize the money market funds.
What's the importance of the interbank loans, guaranteeing the interbank loans? Europe did this first. Now the U.S. is following along. Why is that so important?
Well, the interbank lending market is the way in which banks fund themselves a short term, and they have been refusing to lend to each other since last August. There are two ways of dealing with it. One, which I think would have been a bit better, is just to lend to them directly through the Federal Reserve's discount window, and I suspect, in fact, that that will be the predominant way that banks fund themselves. But guaranteeing their loans does make it possible for banks to borrow from each other without fear that the counterparty will default.
Well, what does that mean, though? I mean, does that mean that banks, if all the loans are guaranteed, can banks make, you know, a lot of risky loans like the ones that got them into this trouble in the first place?
Absolutely. There's a huge element of risk associated with this. And for it to work, it is absolutely essential that the regulators be in place, that the regulators put strict limits on how rapidly banks can grow in this situation. So you don't want a runaway institution taking advantage of the of what is essentially now risk-free access to credit. So banks are basically being transformed into public utilities for the time being, and they need to be regulated as such. And, of course, I don't for a minute think that this administration is going to, in its dying months, do the job properly, but that is crude measures can get us through to January when we have an administration in place which is able to put a regulatory system that can function into position.
The Assistant Treasury Secretary said yesterday that the loan guarantees and which banks the U.S. actually buys equity shares in would focus on healthier banks. Does that mean that many unhealthier banks will still be allowed to fail?
Well, what needs to be done here is to separate those which are in difficulty because of economic conditions or the credit crunch, but are basically have been soundly run institutions, from those which are insolvent or nearing insolvency as a result of mismanagement and fraud. In the second case, then you really have to go in and clean up the institution, get new management, or sell the institution or close it. In the first case, you can operate an institution which is in financial difficulty, but fundamentally a decent institution. You just have to operate under control so that it does not take inordinate risks and do foolish things with the taxpayers' resources. And that's basically the decision that was made in the savings and loan crisis. That basic division was made, and a number of institutions which had been insolvent for a number of years were kept open and eventually survived as viable financial institutions.
Here's another of the president's proposals from this morning. Listen.
Third, the FDIC will immediately and temporarily expand government insurance to cover all non-interest-bearing transaction accounts. These accounts are used primarily by small businesses to cover day-to-day operations. By insuring every dollar in these accounts, we will give small business owners peace of mind and bring greater stability to the banking system.
All right. Sounded like the president was receiving an email in the middle of that statement. What does that mean? A lot of our listeners will not have heard of bank accounts that are not interest bearing. Who puts money? What kind of business puts money into a bank without it being an interest bearing account?
Well, let's say you have funds coming in from your regular business, and you put it into an account with which you're going to pay payroll at the end of the week. And that can run into the hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in the case of a medium-sized business. And so you're not getting interest on that. It's simply a transactions account. But if you are worried about the stability of the small or medium-sized bank that you're in, you're going to be strongly tempted to try and get that money into one of the big banks that are too big to fail. And the effect of that is to basically a run on banks which are considered possible that they might fail. That has been very destabilizing to the banking system. By guaranteeing and insuring those accounts, what the FDIC will do is basically reassure ordinary commercial businesses that they can go about their business without worrying that these short-term transitional funds are at risk.
We can take questions and comments for economist John Galbraith, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehr Show. Is this working? I didn't look at the rate today, but as of yesterday, the LIBOR interbank loan rate, which is a major indicator of whether credit is frozen or not, didn't seem to have come down very much, maybe from doubt if there's enough government money even to go around. What do you make of the lack of movement of the LIBOR, or is it moving more than I think?
I actually don't know. I haven't watched it in the last 24 hours. I'm a little bit suspicious of the LIBOR, the way that that particular rate is created and it's presented. It's a rate which is created by a very small number of banking institutions on what is in recent months very relatively low volume. So it may well be basically administered and somewhat sluggish at the moment. What does worry me about what's happened, I think the plan that we've just seen is actually steps in the right direction. I am quite worried, though, about the way in which the Federal Reserve has moved to provide essentially unlimited support to the European Central Bank, an astonishing development which shows the very great weakness of the euro and the eurozone, something which I think many people didn't really suspect was the case. But we're now in a situation where all of the problems we were just talking about a minute ago about the need for regulation and supervision of financially dependent institutions, that same argument could be applied to the entire to the entirety of Europe, where I would not place a lot of confidence in every case in the bank regulatory authorities. So I think we have a potentially very major problem developing as a result of those steps that have just been taken.
Is Europe still ahead of the United States? It looks like Europe, you know, took these steps, certainly including equity shares, having the governments buy equity shares directly in the banks and the guarantee of all interbank loans, and now the U.S. is following along. Why do you think it took Europe to lead in this direction, and has the U.S. entirely now put itself exactly where Europe is?
Well, certain European governments took this step, beginning, I believe, with Ireland a few days ago. It was really an audacious move on their part because it was very doubtful that if that guarantee of all deposits had been called, that the Irish government could have borrowed the 500 billion euro or whatever it would have taken to make that guarantee good. But they basically were in an extremely unstable position as a result of having a lot of different governments with different policies and the possibility of a run going from a country where deposits were not guaranteed to a country where they were. And that forced the European finance ministers to get together and come up with a coordinated solution, which they have done. But one has to say, it's one hell of a way to run a continent. It is extremely worrying that that European policy has to be made in such an ad hoc fashion. And I think that the arrangement that's now been made between the Eurozone and the United States, again, is one which is really fraught with peril, and that needs to be looked at very carefully in the days ahead to see if there can't be ways to make it a little bit more stable and sustainable.
Again, what's the biggest peril there?
The biggest peril is that some country or set of institutions will run away with the money. You have a situation in which we are basically extending unlimited lending to support the European Central Bank, which then can then lend on to European governments and banking systems. And who is to say that they are all under good regulatory control? They certainly have not been. Spain has been, in particular, a notorious case of a runaway housing bubble and bust. And it's just not obvious to me that one can be sure that the system will in fact be stable, and that we won't have an enormous blow up of the volume of loans that are demanded from the United States.
Here is a great question on interbank lending from Edward in the Bronx. Edward, you're on WNYC. Hi, Edward.
Hi, how are you today?
All right.
My question is, why do banks need to borrow money from each other if they go out and they make loans, they make interest on those loans, and they also take huge amounts of deposits? So why do they need to borrow among themselves?
That is a great question, and I'll bet a lot of people who are not bankers have been scratching their head about that one, Professor Galbraith. If the credit is frozen all over the world, in part because banks aren't loaning to each other these short-term interbank loans, why do banks borrow money from each other all the time?
Well, it's basically an imbalance between where the deposits are and where the loan demand is. And the caller's quite right that you could have a system in which banks do not borrow from each other, in which they fund themselves from deposits. And we could move quite quickly to such a system if we made unlimited insurance of all bank deposits a more or less permanent reality, which is not obvious to me that having extended the limit on FDIC insurance that we will later be able to lower it again. So we may be moving in that direction, but in which case, fundamentally, the banking system becomes like a regulated utility where banks would fund themselves from deposits. They would not borrow from each other. They would borrow as needed from the Federal Reserve. But then the regulators would have to be really quite rigorous about telling them what was and was not permitted. And I think that's not a bad thing. I think we need to go back to a transparent, rather plain vanilla banking system without a lot of fancy instruments and a lot of shell corporations, and certainly without offshore tax havens and all of this other financial rigmarole and hoopla that has made a lot of people rich, but has given us a system which is fundamentally broken and which needs to be reformed, downsized, and made to serve public purposes.
My guest on WNYC, economist James Galbraith from the University of Texas. He contributed to a Harper's Magazine forum for the November issue called How to Save Capitalism, 212-433-WNYC, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer's show. I have a little more on the LIBOR, and I'm curious just to read these numbers and see if you can tell us if it means anything. This says the gap of the three-month dollar-denominated LIBOR or London Interbank Offered Rates over rates on three-month U.S. Treasury bills, I know, folks, this is a lot of econo-speak here, but narrowed to about 422 basis points early today in New York from about 459 basis points late on Friday, which was near the widest in a decade. That was closed yesterday for the holiday. Does this tell you anything about how the credit markets are responding to all these moves?
Well, it tells you that these moves have not made the situation worse, that they've made it perhaps marginally better. But I think we'll have a ways to go before that spread gets down into a reasonable range. 400 and X basis points is a very large number.
Phil in Tribeca, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, good morning, Brian. Good morning, Professor Galbraith. I just wanted to make the comment that it seems to me that the credit crunch is not the problem in itself at all. It's really a symptom of an underlying problem. I mean, I guess the conventional wisdom is that there's really only one issue, and that is the credit crunch. But if we look at things like the default of, or the near bankruptcy of GM, that has very little or nothing to do with the credit crisis. Essentially, it seems to me that the problem is that the consumption demand in the U.S. over the last 5 years or so, or really since the internet boom collapsed, has been driven by the increase in asset prices and also by massive Wall Street profits that have been kind of funneled back into consumption demand through large salaries and shareholder payouts. And now that that has all collapsed, we find out that those asset prices themselves were just a temporary bubble, and that also Wall Street profits, by and large, in themselves were just a temporary bubble. It seems to me that the U.S. has no real industry left, or very little real industry left. There was an article in The Economist recently that stated that 40% of profits in the last 5 years were generated by the financial industry. Those profits we're not going to be seeing again in the foreseeable future.
Now, I'm going to leave it there because you put a lot on the table, but it is a great question, and the kind of big picture question that we invited Professor Galbraith on to address. What do you say to Phil?
Well, I say I deal with this at length in my book, The Predator State. I do think the United States has very great strength still in the technology sector, broadly speaking, and that it has the capacity to develop quite rapidly new aspects of the productive sector, and that we're going to need to do so to deal with our energy questions. But I think the caller is absolutely correct in arguing that the deeper underlying problem behind this crisis is the collapse in asset values, first and foremost in the housing sector, as it was housing prices that underlay both the boom in construction and the rise of home equity, which funded a lot of people's consumption. And that's gone away. And the problem is that there is essentially no collateral left in that sector to support continued spending through loans made against houses. And so what is going to be required here, first of all, there's going to be an enormous overhang, which is going to go on for years in the housing market, of vacant or for sale houses, foreclosed houses, houses people would like to get out of but can't get out of at the prices that would cover their mortgages. And that is a problem which is going to have to be dealt with early in the next administration by setting up something like the Homeowners Loan Corporation of the Great Depression period to renegotiate mortgages, to try and make the payment terms as sustainable as possible, convert people to rentals as necessary, and generally speaking, to try and keep people in their houses, try to keep the housing stock in use so that it doesn't go to waste, so that we don't have a permanent blight on American neighborhoods. That's going to be a crucial step going forward, and it's going to take some years to pull it off. There's also going to be a fall in the purchasing power of the elderly as a result of the collapse in the stock market and other asset values, which are the basis of 401k plans and all of that. And some step needs to be taken to maintain in the aggregate the purchasing power of the elderly population so that you don't have a major fall off of demand on that account. Very importantly, state and local governments, which fund themselves heavily from property taxes, are suffering enormous shortfalls of revenue, and their expenditures need to be maintained. So there needs to be on the table a revenue sharing program that will keep state and local governments in business and prevent them from, discourage them from laying off staff, laying off civil servants, who would then contribute to the housing crisis because that would put them in difficulties paying their mortgages.
This is all
a whole connection of things that need to be done.
And a tremendous amount of federal spending in everything you laid out.
Absolutely. If the private sector cannot finance its spending, the federal sector, the government sector, is going to have to step in and do that job. Sure.
And with what ramifications? If there's more debt, more deficits, you know, they just ran out of digits on the national debt clock on 6th Avenue here in New York because it crossed $10 trillion. Does that have implications for it?
I have to say,
inflation?
The national debt clock is a silly exercise, and having run out of digits, they should turn off the electricity and save a little energy on it. The national debt is not the problem. The United States government can borrow practically for nothing short-term and under 4% for 20- and 30-year periods at this point. Everybody wants to lend to Uncle Sam because he's the most secure borrower out there. Uncle Sam needs to step up to the plate and use that vast authority that he has as the most stable entity in the game to take up the slack that the private sector is giving up. Now, if the private sector were robust and active and willing to do things and in a position to borrow and spend, Uncle Sam doesn't have to do so much, but that is not our situation. And so we are going to have to be reliant on the public sector to get us through this crisis.
Is that why you lead your Harper's article saying the problem is not how to save capitalism, but how to save the unique and successful mixed economy built in the United States over the 85 years since the New Deal?
That is exactly my point, yes. And I think it has been an illusion of the last three decades to say that the United States is some kind of pure free market economy, which we really have never been, and certainly not since the 1930s. But the institutions that we did build up, Social Security and Medicare and the housing finance agencies and the public universities and all the rest, have been enormously successful, far more successful, in fact, than the much more purely socialist institutions of Western Europe. And we need to recognize that the problem that we've had, and again, this is the theme of the predator state, is that we've had a government which has been built upon the abuse of those institutions, their subversion, if you like. In the case of the housing finance sector, they've successfully poisoned the well. It needs to be reconstructed, perhaps even redug entirely. But those institutions are the way to go because they come from the public sector and the dynamism of the private sector.
On the housing problem, $62 trillion is the number that I keep hearing. $62 trillion of credit default swaps that are now of questionable value. That number is way larger than our entire GDP. What does it mean for the future, or shouldn't I get too scared by that number?
I never get too scared by these large capital exposure numbers. It means that a financial sector out there is going to have to be reorganized, and people who work in that sector are going to have to find other things to do or radically change the way they go about their business. Financial sectors can be reorganized. They can be downsized. Since they're not doing something which is absolutely vital to you know, to ordinary life, at least the scale on which they're doing it is much larger than necessary. We should not be afraid of doing that. If we were, you know, if this were our food supply or our transportation system, that would be a different matter.
Here's a comment that a listener wrote in about where he thinks we're headed since the bailout bill. He wrote, "The government has, in essence, acquired more debt to be heaped on the backs of taxpayers while saving the hides of their Wall Street buddies. I can only describe what I see as a sinister synergy between Wall Street and Washington. I never thought my beloved United States would be in the same low league as a Latin American banana republic, but these two centers of power, against the wishes of the populace, have tossed one hell of a banana peel on our path into the future." Unquote. How much of that do you agree with?
I think there is a huge problem of perception, and because there's a problem of perception, it's a real problem. People have lost confidence that the government is operating in the public interest, and this deep interconnection of Wall Street figures in the operation of the financial system in the public sphere, even if they are the best intentioned people in the world who are coming down to Washington to do good work for the public, there's a large part of the public who's simply going to be suspicious of that, and you know, with good reason, good historical reason to be suspicious. I'm not going to pass judgment on Henry Paulson or Mr. Kashkari or other people from the financial sector who are working in Washington. I don't know. But I think there is an enormously powerful case for building a supervisory mechanism and a Department of the Treasury, which is substantially independent of and free from close connections sector.
And that's as we close here, that's how we make it harder for the predators, as your book defines them, to prey on the economy again?
Yes, you have countervailing power, you have autonomy, you have an independence of judgment, and then you try and rebuild the confidence of the broad public that the government is working for them.
Well, this has been so interesting and I think so informative for so many of our listeners. James Galbraith, professor of government at the University of Texas at Austin, author of The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandon the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too, published by the Free Press, and contributor now to the November Harper's Magazine, Harper's Forum, called How to Save Capitalism. Thank you very much, Professor Galbraith.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. More on this in a minute. We'll talk to a congressional candidate from our area who comes not only from Goldman Sachs, but also from a nonprofit that helps people with home equity loans. Stay with us.